Guns are going all around me. In between, birds try and sing. What do they think of this lunacy? I have a stab at reading a book by another loony, Lord Byron. It's appropriate. Child Harold, being read by Child Milligan. He goes on about Italy and Rome. Thy very weeds are beautiful, thy waste more rich than other climes' fertility. Have I got news for him? No, I couldn't stomach Byron today. So, I read what must have been the most up-to-date newspaper in Italy, the Daily Express, January the 7th, 1944. It was flown here on an RAF plane with the contingent of officers, one of whom met Lieutenant Mostyn at a base depot, and in turn it had ended up in the command post. It says here we have a fighter with no propeller, I read aloud. Oh, well, that's due to the shortage of parts, said Vic Nash. I myself have a razor with no blades. It's part of a plan to drive us all bloody mad. I read that there is a test lighting of street lamps in Malpas Road, Deptford. A certain Councillor Coombs pressed a button in the controlling substation and the lights came on. Nash looks up from demudding his boots. A lot of fucking good that's going to do for winning a war. I looked through the paper from end to end. There's not one bloody mention of us, I said. That's it, mate. We are the forgotten army. Forgotten? Forgotten? Don't make me laugh. They've never bloody heard of us. Smudger Smith and Spiv Convine from B Sub have arrived. They are definitely scrounging. You got any fags, Millie? Smudger always called me Millie. He's moaning about not having enough mail. They must be all bleeding crippled from the shoulder down. I've written a dozen bleeding air letters and nothing back. Last one was Christmas. Ha! Women! Ha!
He was right. Ha! Women! Ha!
Oh, good news, Smudger. According to the Daily Express, there is no war on at the moment in Italy. He borrows the paper. I never saw it again. It would come to the same terrible end that all good newspapers came to in the army, even the Times. At that time, I was dreaming of having an after-a-war venture, and I decided that I would like to have a club on the river. Edgington Dean and myself had discussed being partners with Dixie Dean from Hailsham. It would be called either Holiday Inn or Ravello's. Deans would see to the catering. I would have a band, and Harry Edgington would play the piano in the lounge. I had a pad. I was writing down what the requirements of the place were, plates, chairs, etc., etc. Dreams, dreams, dreams.
Come on, you're bloody late.
Sergeant King has bearded me in my lair. I'm sorry, Sarge, I was miles and miles away.
We're all bloody miles away, he said. By the way, they're having a bloody hot time across the river. We're through to them on the wireless. They're at TAC HQ where Looney is.
Lieutenant Budden party are up Dimiano trying to establish an OP. We walk together to the command post. He leaves me at the entrance. Hurry up, Milligan, says Lieutenant Wright. We're off again. Bomberty Edwards had been working the phone, the wireless and the tannoy. What's it feel like to be fully employed, Eddie? I said, taking over the earphones. Bomberty Edwards was a gift to the army. He did his job to full measure. Never complained. First class at his profession of specialist. Clean, shaved every morning, even in cold water. But 5'10", black head, not in any way good looking. Prominent teeth. Never said much. But when we were all getting pissed out of our tiny minds, Eddie would be doing watercolors and sketches of the landscape. We noticed at dances, whenever he took the floor, he appeared to be on wheels and his lady partner was pushing him around the floor. At OPs he was very brave. Well, braver than me. He wouldn't flinch when one dropped near, and I did. I flinched when they didn't drop near. I even flinched when nothing was happening. I was an inveterate flincher. I flinched after the war on hearing the first cuckoo. The weather is now glorious, a faint promise of spring. Warmth is in the air. The sun is in a cloudless sky, and the Germans must be cursing it as the RAF and the USSAF pound the daylights out of them. Suddenly, there are no more fire orders. All round guns are going, all except us. Is it because we're Jewish? We all stare into the command post fire. It stares back. We're all pissed off and trying to find comfort in dreams. I think I'd like to be walking along the front at Brighton with Margaret, said Edwards. At the hour of 5, I was glad to see Sergeant King come back and take over. I go straight to bed. My backside is on fire. I swallowed 6 aspirins trying to kill the pain. My diary. Files arrived back from the OP with Ernie Hart, all badly shaken. Hart is crying. Those poor buggers up there, he says. Lieutenant Wright calls a few remaining signals together. Look, he sounds uneasy. They need a signal replacement up at TAC HQ. Are there any volunteers? There's an embarrassing silence. I can't stand it. I'll go, sir, I heard myself say. I was the only NCO there. I had to say it. Example and all that. So, Mr. Files, you have come to take me for a nice little ride. Alf Files smirks. His eyes tell a different story. January 20, 1944. Going to Dimiano OP. I get into the jeep next to Alf, and we set off. He didn't say much until we got through Loro, and then onto a railway track, now denuded of rails and used as a communication road. It was a lovely sunny day. Suddenly Alf said, "Ah, this is beautiful. This sunshine, birds sing, I could do with more of this back here." He told me the OP and the Major's HQ were both in dodgy positions. Hart had been up the OP, and it had finished him. Jerry was ramming everything onto them. It all sounded grim, and I wondered what my lot would be. The sounds of artillery faded as small arms, automatic weapons, and mortars increased. We were passing a steady stream of ambulances. One, I noticed, had shrapnel holes in the sides. We turned off the railway embankment onto a country road, really a cart track. A 1 mile sign read, Castleforte, 5 kilometres. "How's Jenkins been behaving?" I said. Files smirked. "He sent everyone up to the OP except himself. I think he's shit scared. That or balmy." I didn't fancy being in any way mixed up with Jenkins. He was humourless. I didn't understand him at all. No one did. God help me, I was soon to find out what a lunatic he was. I was already tired, having been awake for 2 nights, and piles were giving me hell. We approached the ferry bridge over the Garigliano. Jerry was lobbing occasional shells into the smoke that was being used to obscure the crossing. From the smoke loomed the pontoon ferry, bearing the load of wounded. Some looked pleased to be out of it, others looked stunned, others, with morphia, were just staring up from their stretchers. "Any more for the Woolwich ferry?" says a cheerful cockney voice. We and several other vehicles were moved forward. Among them, a truck loaded with dynamite. A few more Jerry shells land in the river. By the sound, they are very close. We can't see for the smoke, so we stopped. Through the smoke, a figure with outstretched arm to stop us going off the end, as apparently had happened earlier. A jeep driver, the idiot, thinking it was a continuous bridge, roared off the end, surfaced, swearing, "Where's the rest of the bloody bridge?" More shells. We are moving. We drive off the other side. To our left looms Mount Dimiano. "That's what all the trouble's about," said Files. "Our OP's on there, somewhere." Off the road to our right is a cluster of farmhouses, some shelled, some intact. "This is it," said Files, as we turn right into them. We pulled up in front of the centermost, a two-storied affair. All around are dead Jerrys and British. Machine gun bullets are whistling overhead as we duck and run inside. It's a large room. On a makeshift table was a .22 set. There was Jenkins. Laying down at the far end of the room, Flash Gordon, Birch, Fuller, Howard, Badgie Ballard, Dipper Dyer, all looking as gloomy as hell. "It isn't the war," whispered Birch. "It's Jenkins." "Milligan, you get to that set right away," said Jenkins. I took over from Fuller. Immediately, Jenkins sends RHQ a series of pointless messages. "It's very stuffy in the room. There are 8 ORs, 2 NCOs, and myself. Thornton is coming back. The Germans are shelling us. The Germans have stopped shelling us." I didn't exactly know what his job was supposed to be. The people who were taking the stick were Lieutenant Budden and party, who were being stonked unmercifully. In this room, save for a direct hit, we were comparatively safe. From the time I arrived, about 4 p.m, the bastard kept me on the set all night, total of 17 hours with the headphones on. This was my third night without sleep. Just the noise of the interference was enough to drive you potty. To get a break, I said, "Do you think, sir, under the articles of war, I could be relieved so I could relieve myself?" Even then he said, "Well, hurry up!" I felt like saying, "I will piss as fast as I can, sir. Would you like someone to tie me in case I loiter?" Outside, a young lieutenant was talking to a sergeant. "Then why didn't they stay inside? I mean, those inside didn't get killed." I presume he was referring to the unburied dead who lay without the walls. It was dark. A stream of empty bullets whined over the roof. God knows what he was aiming at. Nothing behind us. Overhead, stars shone. Back in Major Jenkins' salon for the morose, I went back on the set. At that moment, a terrific explosion shook the farm. It was Jerry 155mm shell. He continued to carry out harassing fire throughout the night. I think it was the road to the ferry bridge he was after, but he moved around a bit. I continued to relay lunatic messages. "The Germans have started shelling us. There's an interval of 2 minutes between each round." And this is his most unbelievable one. "Every time we transmit a message, he shells us." The idiot was implying that Jerry had a device that made it possible to locate the position of a wireless set by its transmission. Of course, there was absolutely no truth in this statement. When we didn't transmit, Jerry shelled us. So how did he become a major? Men's lives were in his hands. Like all lunatics, he had unending energy. As dawn came, he got worse. I was almost numb with fatigue. My piles had started to bleed again. I should never have volunteered. One of the lads made breakfast. While I was eating, Jenkins tells me, "Bombardier, I want you to take Gordon, Howard, Burts and Ballard to the OP with fresh batteries." "Great. All I have to do is to carry a 50-pound battery to the top of a mountain with bleeding piles. Anything else? Like how about a mild run in medieval armour with plague?" Ballard apparently knows the way. At 9 o'clock, we put on Arctic packs and strap on one battery each. We set off single file on the road towards Castelforte, which sits in the near distance on a hillside full of Germans. We turn left off the road into a field. We pass a Sherman tank, a neat hole punched in the turret. Tank man is removing kit from inside. Lying on a ground sheet is the mangled figure of one of the crew. "Oh, what a mess," said the tank man, in the same tones as though there was mud on the carpet. I grinned at him and passed on. Above us, the battle was raging full belt. "Coming towards us is it? It's Thornton, dear old 35-year-old gunner Thornton. He looks tired. He has no hat. Has he sold it? And he's smoking a pipe. Hello, what's on?" I say. He explains he's been sent back. "I'm too old for that lark. I keep falling asleep." I ask him the best way up. He reaffirms. "You go up a stone-lined gully. When it ends, start climbing the hill. It's all step for olive groves. Of course," he added, "if you're in a gully and they start mortaring, you've had it." "Oh, thanks," I said. "That's cheer us up no end." He bid us farewell and we went forward. We reached the gully. In a ravine to the left were infantry all dug into the side. They were all resting or in reserve. So far, so good. We reached the end of the stone gully and started climbing the step mountain. Each step is 6 foot high, so it's a stiff climb. Grump, grump, grump. "Mortars!" We hit the ground. Grump, grump, grump. They stop. Why? "Can they see us?" We get up and go on. Grump, grump, grump. "They can see us." We hit the deck. A rain of them fall around us. I cling to the ground. The mortars deluge down on us. Out of a fag, that's what. I'm holding a packet of woodbines. Then there is a noise like thunder. It's right in my head. There's a high-pitched whistle in my ears. At first, I black out. And then, I see red. I'm strangely dazed. I was on my front, and now I'm on my back. The red was opening my eyes straight into the sun. I know if I stay here, we'll all die. I start to scramble down the hill. Grump, grump, grump. They're shouting. I can't recall anything clearly. Next, I was at the bottom of the mountain. Next, I'm speaking to Major Jenkins. I'm crying. I don't know why. He's saying, "Get that wound rest." I said, "What wound?" "I've been hit on the side of the right leg." "Why did you come back?" He's shouting at me and threatening me. I can't remember what I'm saying. He's saying, "You could find your way back here, but you couldn't find your way to the OP." Next, I'm sitting in an ambulance and shaking. An orderly puts a blanket around my shoulders. I'm crying again. But why? 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 Next, I'm in a forward dressing station. An orderly gives me a bowl of hot sweet tea. Swallow these, he said. Two small white pills. I can't hold the bowl for shaking. He takes it from me and helps me drink it. All around are wounded. He has rolled up my trouser leg. He's putting a sticking plaster on the wound. He's telling me it's only a small one. I don't really care if it's a big one or small. Why am I crying? Why can't I stop? I'm getting lots of sympathy. What I want is an explanation. I'm feeling drowsy. I must have started to sway, because next I'm on a stretcher. I feel lovely. What were those tablets? That's the stuff for me. Who wants food? I don't know how long I'm there. I wake up. I'm still on the stretcher. I'm not drowsy, but I start to shiver. I sit up. They put a label on me. They get me to my feet and help me to an ambulance. I can see really badly wounded men, their bandages soaked through with blood. Plasma is being dripped into them. When we come to one of the Red Cross trucks, an Italian woman, all in black, young, beautiful, is holding a dead baby and weeping. Someone says the child has been killed by a shell splinter. The relatives are standing by, looking out of place in their ragged peasant clothing amid all the uniforms. An older woman gives her a plate of homemade biscuits, of no possible use, just a desperate gesture of love. She sits in front with the driver. I'm in the back. We all sit on seats facing each other. Not one face can I remember. Suddenly we are passing through our artillery lines. As the guns fire, I jump at each explosion, and then a gesture I will never forget. A young soldier next to me, with his right arm in a bloody sling, put his good arm around my shoulder and tried to comfort me. "There, there," said, "you be all right, mate." We arrive at a camp. I was put into a tent on a bunk bed. An orderly gave me four tablets and more hot tea. In a few seconds, they put me out like a light. I'd finished being a useful soldier. I've had it. Here's Dipper Dyer's version, though it's a lot different from mine. However, all this time, Jerry was belting away at us, so even getting the rope across the river was no mean feat by whoever managed it. Once on the bank of the river, there was still a good march to the base of Dimiano, and Bombardier Milligan and I were given the job of carrying a large coil of telephone wire attached to a drum, which took two men to carry by holding a pole to the centre of the drum. What with packs on our back, carrying Tommy guns and wire, and the state of the terrain, I was beginning to wish I was back at base with my gun-towing Scammel. Spike and I trudged on until we were nearing Dimiano. At the foot of the hill we came to a gully. Suddenly, mortar shelling became really violent, and I dived for cover in a cranny at the side of the hill. Spike fell to the ground and seemed very badly shell-shocked and affected, especially his backside. I helped him to his feet and carried him to the best of my ability to a first aid post where I left him. Thank you, Dipper. Especially in the backside area. I should get a medal for that. I wake up. It's very early, and am I stark raving mad? I can distinctly hear a brass band right outside the tent, and they are playing Roll Out the Barrel at an incredible speed. I get up, look outside. There, in a circle, stand a collection of GIs, all playing this tune. They are in a strange collection of garments, some in overcoats with bare legs and boots, some in pyjamas, others in underpants, unlaced boots and sweaters. An extraordinary mixture. I looked at my watch. It was 06:45. This, I discovered, was the American Reveille. Tune finished, the men doubled back to their beds. But where was I? It was a large hospital tent, full of bunks with sleeping soldiers. I was the only one awake, and I was still fully dressed, save my battle dress jacket. The first time I felt my right leg aching. I sat on the side of the bed and took the plaster off my leg to look at the wound. It was about 2 inches long and about a quarter of an inch deep, as though I had been slashed with a razor blade. It wasn't hindering me, so what was I here for? I lit up a cigarette. It was one of my five remaining woodbines, now very crushed. Two RAMC orderlies entered the tent, young lads. They go around the beds, looking at the labels. They woke some of the men up and gave them tablets. They arrived at me. I asked them where I was. They told me it was 144 Casualty Clearing Station. I was labelled Battle Fatigue. I was to see a psychiatrist that evening. Meantime, there was a mess tent where I could get breakfast. I told them I didn't have any small kit. "Don't worry, lad. They've got knives and forks back there." Lad? So I was a lad now. Oh, it was a wretched time. No small kit, no towel, no soap, no friends. It's amazing what small, simple things really make up of our life support system. All I wanted was some cold water on my face. I went across to the American camp, and from a GI, of all things, smoking a cigar, I scrounged a towel. He was more than generous. He took me to his quartermaster, who gave me 2 brand-new khaki-coloured towels, soap and a razor. I'm afraid I was still in a very emotional state, and I started to cry. Thanks, but apparently they were aware that the camp next to them were battle-fatigue cases. I wandered through a mess of tents till I found the ablutions. It was still only 7:30, but the place was full. There was the terrible silence of a mass of people who didn't know each other. I washed in silence, and the coals, and I'm stuck for words, so Agent continues, it was all sticky. My God, what a mess. Blood. The curse of the millings is still working. What I really want is a bath. I'm given 2 different sized pills. I ask what they are. The orderly says, I don't know, chum. Oh, I'm chum now. He knows, all right. But it's early days for tranquilizers. Take them after breakfast. I have absolutely no recollection of eating breakfast. I think I took the tablets right away. Next thing it was evening. I was very dopey. You've got to see the trick cyclist, says the young orderly. I have no idea what trick cyclist meant. I asked. Psychiatrist? That was for lunatics. Was I one? I was to find out. In a small office-type tent, behind an army folding table covered with a grey blanket, sits a stern, or rather attempting to look stern, officer. He is a captain, middle-aged, a small, almost pencil-thin moustache. He asks me all those utterly boring questions, name, religion, etc. He asks me what happens. I tell him as much as I can recall. He is telling me that it takes 100,000 shells before one soldier is killed. I said, really? Who is he? He ends with a much louder voice than before. You're going to get better, understand? Yes, sir, understand. I'm back in my tent, still a bit airy-fairy in the head. I'd never had mind drugs before. I get an evening meal. There's no lighting in the hospital tents. The orderlies come round with a tilly lamp, and I get more knockout pills. Next morning, roll out the barrel. It's a great place for battle fatigue. A week here, and we roll out the battle fatigue. I'm to be sent back to the regiment. I suppose they know what they're doing. Time was to prove that they didn't. How I got back to the battery, I don't know. This was a time of my life that was very demoralized. I was not really me anymore. Back to the mob. January the 27th, 1944. The battery are still at Laurel in the same position. The first thing I noticed are the graves of those who had died on the night of the fire. B.S.M. Griffin is pottering around the graves, tidying them up. They have white crosses and the names written on them. The tradition of putting the deceased's steel helmet on the cross still persists. One suspects that it happened at Thermopylae. I'm so miserable. The spring that made me Spike Milligan is gone. I'm a zombie. Anyone could say I'd do anything to me. I hear that those who had been with me on the OP fiasco had all been given 7 days leave. Why not me? As soon as the guns start to fire, I start to jump. I try to control it. I run to my dugout and I stay there. I suddenly realize that I'm stammering. What a bloody mess. The major thinks I'm a coward. Perhaps I am. If so, why didn't I run away from the line the first day in action in North Africa? I'm aware that the date is January the 27th. A whole week? Where have I been? I'm on duty in the command post and I really shouldn't be. I managed to stop crying, but I'm now stammering very badly. So I can't be of any use passing wireless messages or fire orders. I just copy down the sit-reps. They put me on the telephone exchange. January the 28th, 1944. The whole week is still very bitty in terms of remembering it. I'd been told to report to the MO every morning. When he saw me and heard the incredible stammer I had, I knew he was going to send me away from the battery for good. In retrospect, if the idiot had sent me back for a few weeks in the first place, I'm sure I would have been all right. But the Major, who was an unthinking bastard, loved playing God. What did he know about 19 Battery? He was a regular bastard. We weren't regulars. He was used to a life of regimental hopping. I suppose in his career he'd been in hundreds of units, one very much the same as the others. But for us, this was not so. We'd always been in one battery right from the start. The feeling of togetherness was something he never participated in, but we still have it. We have two reunions a year. No other mob has that going for them. We were unique. We never heard from Jenkins. After the war, he'd never been to a reunion, but he really didn't belong to us. We're still together. I doubt if he is. I remember at the time thinking I'd like to order a council steamroller to drive over him, instructing the driver to go as slow as possible. It then could be used as a bookmarker. He lived on that one narrow plane, and everyone had to be judged by that. He didn't know of deeper or higher feelings. Those were the areas he could not enter. The bloody fool had got rid of someone who was deeply attached to the battery and the lads. Yet the bastard had made me stay at the gun position. The noise of the gun for boost of morale, the bloody fool said. It didn't. The noise drove me mad. Came one of the saddest days in my life. I had to leave. I got up very early. I didn't say goodbye to anyone. I got in the truck alongside Driver Wright. As I drove down that muddy mountain road, with the morning mist filling the valleys, I felt as though I was being taken across the Styx. I never got over that feeling. "Do you know where I'm going?" asked Driver Wright. "Yes, it's 865 FDS. February the 10th, 1944. My diary landed up in No. 2 General Hospital, Caserta. This was a real hospital, or rather they made it so. The weather was sunny, and I was shown into a long ward with lots of windows to let the light and air in. It had a polished stone floor. The walls and the ceilings were painted white. Beds along the walls. Down the centre were trestle tables with books and a few pots of flowers. Very pleasant. I was soon in bed, dressed in blue service pyjamas. This was a psychiatric ward with about 50 patients in. About two-thirds were under drugs and slept most of the day. The remainder were very silent and morose. No one spoke to anyone. All day and every day I just sat in the bed and read. I've wondered if I did anything apart from that. I've checked my letter list. I noted that I wrote to my father on January the 22nd, to Louis Dumford on January the 30th, and then I noticed acknowledged all mail on the 30th of January. By chance, one of those letters still exists, the one to my father. I don't mention my ordeal, but I say I passed the hours reading poetry. By now, my parents had been informed of me being a casualty. They were living at Orchard Way, Reigate, when the telegram arrived. It was stamped OHMS War Office. My mother had opened the door, and when she saw it, she called to my father. "I can't open it." They said they felt I'd been killed. Parents must have spent a lifetime of anguish as they opened the telegrams, not knowing the contents. I was to see Major Palmer, a psychiatrist whom I believe invented the revolutionary deep narcosis for the treatment of battle fatigue. My turn came for the interview. I told him that being in hospital, I was only taking up bed space. What I needed was a job to occupy me. He looked up and said, "I appreciate that. A lot of the bastards like to malinger here as long as they can." He was a rugged-looking man with a broken nose, a relic from his amateur boxing days. I was told of a Scottish soldier who had seen him because of an ungovernable temper. "So you lose your temper, do you?"
"Aye, and I'll lash out."
"Would you hit me?"
"Aye, I would."
"Well, go and try." The Scot had lashed out. Palmer had parried and riposted with a right to the jaw, felling the Scotsman. A new form of psychiatry. I wondered if it cured him. He had me posted to a rehabilitation camp north of Naples. March the 9th, 1944. I'm on a lorry with a lot of other PNs. It takes us to a terrible muddy field next to a small suburb called Afrigola. I was to be a reception clerk. That is, I sat in a tent at the entrance of the camp with a lot of army forms. As the PNs came in, I took down their details and put them in a file. All day long, the battle-weary soldiers filed in. I was asked the same question, what are they going to do to me? And there was a hollow fear in each voice. Some cried, God made gentle people as well as strong ones. Alas for the war effort. I was a gentle one. Now, will Milligan recover? Will he get back into the big time amongst the Lance Bombardier set? Above all, will he lose that stammer that makes him take 4 hours to say good morning? All this and more in Volume 5, Goodbye Soldier, to be serialized in Gay News, the end.